You are all warmly welcome to this public examination where Master of Arts Katariina Ruuska defends her doctoral thesis at the nexus of language, identity and ideology, becoming and being a highly proficient second language speaker of Finnish. The opponent is Associate Professor Peter D. Costa from Michigan State University. He participates in this public defense online. Welcome. We will first hear the Lectio Precursoria given by Katariina Ruuska. This part is in Finnish and it takes 20 minutes. After that, we switch into English again. As the custos appointed by the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences, I declare this public examination of the dissertation of Master of Arts Katariina Ruuska opened.
Arvoisa kustos, kunnioitettu vastaväittäjä, hyvät kuulijat. Kun aloin suunnitella tätä lektiota, aivan aluksi minun oli päätettävä, millä kielellä sen pidän. Koska väittelen suomen kielen oppiaineesta, mutta väitöskirjani on englanninkielinen, tämä päätös ei ollut suoraviivainen. Päädyin siis tutkimaan yliopiston ohjeita väitöstilaisuuden järjestämisestä, ja sieltä löytyi seuraava kohta. Jos väittelijä on suomenkielinen, myös lektio on yleensä suomenkielinen. Tällöin väittelijän tulee tehdä ulkomaalaiselle vastaväittäjälle lyhennelmä englanniksi. Tämä ohje vaikuttaa ensisilmäyksellä selkeältä ja neutraalilta. Siihen piiloutuu kuitenkin kaksi tärkeää ennakko-oletusta. Ensinnäkään ohjeessa ei selvennetä, ketä tarkoitetaan suomenkielisellä henkilöllä, vaan oletetaan, että tämä on kaikille selvää. Luultavasti suomenkielisellä siis tarkoitetaan suomea äidinkielenään puhuvaa henkilöä. Toiseksi ohjeessa oletetaan, että ulkomaalainen vastaväittäjä ei suinkaan osaa suomea, vaan hän tarvitsee englanninkielisen käännöksen lektiosta. Vaikka jälkimmäinen oletus pitää käytännössä varmaan useimmiten paikansa, näillä kahdella lyhyellä virkkeellä luodaan kuitenkin mielenkiintoinen vastakkainasettelu. Suomenkielisen vastakohtana on ulkomaalainen. Suomen kielen osaaminen liitetään siis itsestään selvällä tavalla suomalaisuuteen ja suomen kielen osaamattomuus ulkomaalaisuuteen. Yliopiston väitöstilaisuuden järjestämistä koskevat ohjeet eivät ole ainoa konteksti, jossa voi törmätä vastaavanlaisiin käsityksiin. Kun itse tulin Suomeen 12 vuotta sitten, jopa melko alkeistasolla ollutta suomen kielen taitoani ihmeteltiin avoimesti ja paljon. Toisaalta usein sattui niin, että minulle puhuttiin automaattisesti englantia, koska olin ulkomaalainen. Mitä enemmän kielitaitoni kehittyi, sitä paremmin pääsin mukaan suomalaiseen yhteiskuntaan ja kulttuuriin, mutta sitä useammin tuli myös vastaan tilanteita, joissa olin ainoa ei-äidinkielinen puhuja. Näistä henkilökohtaisista kokemuksista saivat alkunsa ensin maisterin tutkielmani ja sittemmin väitöskirjani. Kiinnostuin ensinnäkin siitä, miten tällainen tiettyä kieltä ympäröivä ilmapiiri vaikuttaa kielen oppijoiden kokemuksiin. Toiseksi pohdin, mitä tapahtuu, kun suomea toisena kielenä puhuvien ihmisten kielenkäyttö ja kielen taitotaso eivät selvästikään vastaa stereotyyppisiä odotuksia. Tutkijana olin myös kiinnostunut siitä, mitä hyvin edistyneiden kielenoppijoiden kokemukset voivat kertoa meille näistä kieltä ja puhujia koskevista oletuksista. Kielen tutkimuksessa tämän tyyppisiä oletuksia on tutkittu kieliideologian käsitteen avulla. Kieliideologioilla tarkoitetaan vakiintuneita käsityksiä kielistä ja puhujista. Kieliideologiasta on esimerkiksi kyse, kun yleisesti ajatellaan, että suomen kieli on vaikea oppia aikuisena, vaikka moni oppiikin suomea hyvin aikuisiässä. Kieliideologiasta on myös kyse, kun oletetaan, että ei-äidinkielisen puhujan voi melko helposti tunnistaa aksentin tai kielioppivirheiden perusteella, vaikka esimerkiksi myös äidinkielenään suomea puhuvien puheessa esiintyy paljon kielenkäyttöä, joka voitaisiin myös tulkita virheelliseksi. Tutkimuksessani olen yhdistänyt kieli-ideologioihin kaksi muutakin avainkäsitettä: identiteetti ja kielellinen legitimiteetti. Identiteetin osalta olin kiinnostunut siitä, miten puhujat asemoituvat ja tulevat asemoiduiksi vuorovaikutustilanteessa. Esiintyykö ja kohdataanko suomea toisena kielenä puhuva henkilö esimerkiksi kielenoppijana vai itsenäisenä ja pätevänä kielenkäyttäjänä? Ja miten näistä rooleista neuvotellaan? Kielellisen legitimiteetin näkökulma taas viittaa siihen, miten puhujan sosiaalinen asema vaikuttaa hänen mahdollisuuksiinsa osallistua tilanteisiin tasavertaisena ja merkittävänä toimijana. Onko toisen kielen puhujan mahdollista saada oma äänensä kuulluksi esimerkiksi työpalaverissa, vai estyykö tämä joidenkin hienonvaraisten käytänteiden ja näkymättömien normien takia? Tutkimukseni lähtökohta on, että kieli-ideologiat, puhujien identiteetit ja kielellinen legitimiteetti liittyvät tiiviisti toisiinsa ja muodostavat neksuksen eli risteymän. Tutkimalla tätä risteymää saadaan tietoa siitä, mitä kukin puhuja voi kielitaidollaan tehdä ja millä ehdoin hän on osa kieliyhteisöä. Tutkimukseeni osallistui yhteensä 12 aikuista. He olivat kotoisin 6 eri maasta: Puolasta, Ranskasta, Saksasta, Tšekistä, Unkarista ja Venäjältä. Ja tutkimushetkellä osallistujat olivat asuneet Suomessa noin vuodesta 13 vuoteen. Syyt Suomeen muuttoon olivat erilaisia. Jotkut olivat muuttaneet suomalaisen kumppaninsa perässä, toiset, koska he olivat kiinnostuneita suomen kielestä ja Suomesta maana, esimerkiksi opiskelijavaihdon myötä. Jotkut olivat aloittaneet suomen kielen opiskelun jo kotimaassaan, toiset vasta Suomeen saapuessaan. Kaikkia yhdisti se, että he olivat yleensä itseopiskelun kautta saavuttaneet erittäin korkean suomen kielen taitotason. Jopa niin korkean, että kaikille heistä oli ainakin joskus käynyt niin, että heitä pidettiin äidinkielenään suomea puhuvina ihmisinä. Englanniksi tätä ilmiötä kutsutaan passing for a native speaker. Toteutin tutkimuksen etnografisella otteella. Tein laadullisia haastatteluja kaikkien 12 osallistujan kanssa, ja 4 heistä pääsin myös seuraamaan tarkemmin eri tilanteissa, esimerkiksi työpaikalla tai harrastuksissa. Aineistona olivat siis sekä osallistujien omat kertomukset että minun havaintoni tutkijana. Aineiston analyysissä minua kiinnosti se, miten kieli-ideologiat eli käsitykset suomen kielestä heijastuvat osallistujien kokemuksiin ja miten osallistujani reagoivat kohtaamiinsa kieli-ideologioihin. Tarkastelin myös sitä, miten osallistujat hahmottavat omaa suhdettaan suomen kieleen ja miten he neuvottelevat asemastaan suomen kielen käyttäjinä kielenkäyttönsä kautta. Analyysissä käytin neksusanalyysin ja narratiivisen analyysin työkaluja. Tutkimusaineistoni analyysi tuotti monitahoisen kuvan osallistujieni identiteeteistä ja käytänteistä. Nostan tässä lektiossa esiin 3 keskeistä analyysin tulosta. Ensinnäkin aineistoni analyysissä kävi ilmi, että kieli-ideologiat vaikuttavat ratkaisevasti siihen, miten edistyneitä suomea toisena kielenä puhuvia kategorisoidaan arjessa. Melkein kaikki osallistujat kertoivat, että heitä pidetään ensikohtaamisissa yleensä suomen ruotsalaisina tai virolaisina. Tämä on mielenkiintoinen havainto, koska toistuvana tällainen luokittelu viittaa siihen, että suomen kielen oppimista erittäin hyvin pidetään todennäköisenä vain silloin, kun oppija on kasvanut Suomessa tai puhuu lähisukukieltä äidinkielenään. Osallistujani kertoivat myös, että he törmäävät usein yllättyneisiin reaktioihin, kun he kertovat taustastaan. Yhden osallistujan sanoin: suomalaiset eivät yksinkertaisesti odota, että on olemassa ihmisiä, jotka puhuvat suomea tavalla, että ei voi heti ensimmäisen lauseen perusteella päätellä, että he ovat ulkomaalaisia. Nämä kokemukset osoittavat, että Suomessa vallitsee edelleen vahva olettama siitä, että suomen kielen oppiminen on vaikeaa ja siitä, että suomen kielen sujuva käyttö ja suomalaisuus liittyvät itsestään selvästi toisiinsa. Toiseksi tutkimukseni osoittaa, että nämä käsitykset ja odotukset vaativat osallistujiltani tarkkaa identiteettityötä ja asemoinnin neuvottelua. Esimerkiksi se, että osallistujiani pidettiin joskus äidinkielenään suomea puhuvina, oli tutkimuksen valossa yllättävän monimutkainen ilmiö. Helposti voisi kuvitella, että äidinkielisestä meneminen on selkeä merkki menestyksekkäästä kielen oppimisesta. Todellisuudessa osallistujani kuitenkin pelkäävät antavansa negatiivisen vaikutelman. Jos heitä pidetään äidinkielisinä, epätavalliset ilmaukset tai sanavalinnat saatetaan tulkita oudoiksi tai epäsympaattisiksi. Jos heitä taas tunnistetaan suomea toisena kielenä puhuviksi, sujuva suomen kielen käyttö herättää positiivisia reaktioita. Siksi useimmat osallistujat yrittivätkin välttää äidinkielisestä menemistä kertomalla oma-aloitteisesti taustastaan. Ei-suomenkielisyyden esille tuominen koettiin siis eduksi. Samoin murrepiirteiden ja puhekielen käyttö oli tutkimuksessani ristiriitaiseksi koettu ilmiö. Toisaalta osallistujille oli tärkeää ja luontevaa kuulua joukkoon ja puhua samalla tavalla kuin heidän lähipiirinsäkin. Toisaalta varsinkin murteiden suhteen muualta Suomeen tulleina he kuitenkin myös kyseenalaistivat oikeuttaan käyttää paikallisia kielimuotoja. Tähän liittyy siis myös kysymys kielen omistajuudesta. Tutkimuksessani olen tulkinnut, että tällaisten pohdintojen ja niihin liittyvien asemointistrategioiden tavoitteena on nimenomaan kielellisen legitimiteetin saavuttaminen. Tutkimuksen kolmas tärkeä tulos on, että kielelliseen legitimiteettiin liittyvät haasteet voivat juontua myös vakiintuneista rakenteista ja käytänteistä. Hyvin edistyneet suomen oppijat ovat usein ainoita ei-äidinkielisiä suomen puhujia työ- tai opiskelukavereidensa joukossa. Esimerkiksi yksi tutkimukseni osallistujista kertoi, että suomenkielisessä opinto-ohjelmassaan ainoa ei-äidinkielinen suomen puhuja ja että opettajilla oli hyvin vähän kokemusta hänen kaltaisistaan opiskelijoista. Opettajat tukivat häntä siis joko liikaa tai liian vähän. Yksi opettaja esimerkiksi ei antanut osallistujani puhua itse tuntien aikana, vaan toimi tulkkina osallistujani ja luokan välillä. Kun sitten sama opettaja huomasi, että osallistujani pärjäsikin hyvin suomeksi, esimerkiksi kurssipalautusten tiukoista aikatauluista ei enää joustettu, vaikka osallistujani olisi joskus tarvinnut enemmän aikaa laatia tehtävänsä suomeksi. Toisen kielen puhujien mahdollisuudet oppia, osallistua ja kokea kuuluvansa yhteisöön määräytyvät siis myös ympäristön implisiittisten normien kautta. Jos muita kuin äidinkielisiä suomen puhujia ei osata odottaa, toisen kielen puhujien tarpeet ja erilaisuus saattavat korostua liikaa tai toisaalta jäädä näkymättömiksi. Päinvastainen kokemus oli toisella osallistujalla, jonka nykyisellä työpaikalla oli paljon eritaustaisia suomen puhujia. Hän koki, että toisin kuin aiemmissa työyhteisöissä, tällä työpaikalla hän ei enää ollut se ulkomaalainen, vaan tavallinen suomen kielen käyttäjä. Sosiaalisten ympäristöjen kielellinen ja kulttuurinen monimuotoisuus ja erityisesti se, että yhteisössä on samankaltaisia puhujia, joihin toisen kielen puhuja voi identifioitua, ovat siis keskeisiä kielellisen legitimiteetin kannalta. Kielen oppimisen suhteen maallikkokäsityksissä huomio kiinnittyy usein kielitaidon puutteisiin ja oppijoiden tekemiin virheisiin. Kielen oppimisen tutkimuksessa puolestaan on pitkään keskitytty kielen oppimisen rakennetason ilmiöihin, esimerkiksi siihen, missä järjestyksessä opitaan mitäkin muotoja. Viime aikoina kielen oppimisen sosiaalinen puoli on kuitenkin noussut tutkimuksessa yhä keskeisemmäksi osaksi analyysiä. On tarkasteltu muun muassa sitä, miten kieltä opitaan konkreettisesti eri sosiaalisissa tilanteissa ja ympäristöissä. Kielen oppiminen ymmärretään jatkuvaksi prosessiksi, johon kuuluu ratkaisevasti oppijasta itsenäiseksi kielenkäyttäjäksi siirtyminen. Omassa tutkimuksessani olen tarkastellut sitä, miten kieliyhteisön ideologiat ja sosiolingvistiset normit vaikuttavat tähän puhujuuden rakentamiseen. Tutkimukseni osoittaa, että myös poikkeuksellisen menestyksekkäät kielenoppijat joutuvat yhä uudelleen neuvottelemaan asemastaan lähiyhteisöissään ja laajemmassa kieliyhteisössä. Kyse on viime kädessä siitä, miten suomenkielisyys ymmärretään tällä hetkellä ja minkälaisen suomenkielisen identiteetin kielen aikuisena oppineet voivat rakentaa tämän ymmärryksen puitteissa. Mitä moninaisempi ja monikielisempi suomen kieliyhteisöstä tulee, sitä laajemmin yhteisön on ymmärrettävä suomenkielisyys. Tähän muutokseen kaikki yhteisön jäsenet voivat omalta osaltaan osallistua. Itse päätin loppujen lopuksi kirjoittaa ja pitää tämän lektion suomeksi. Se on symbolinen ele ja kunnianosoitus pääaineelleni, mutta ehkä päätöksessä oli mukana myös pieni tarve todistaa, että kyllä, minä todellakin osaan suomea. Tulevaisuutta ajatellen toivon toki, että kukaan ei välttämättä enää kokisi tätä todistamisen tarvetta, vaan että suomenkieliset ulkomaalaiset olisivat itsestäänselvä osa tätä kieliyhteisöä. Honored Associate Professor, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, please present the comments that you see my dissertation has given grounds for.
Thank you, Katerina, for that opening lecture. I appreciate the English translation that you sent me over the weekend. And greetings, everyone, from Chicago, where I am right now. Some of you might have been following over the past week the US presidential elections. You may understand, of course, that the whole process was very much characterized by identity and ideological conflicts. You may have also have heard about plans to build a wall with Mexico. There are, of course, two ways to approach the situation: a stance of hostility or one of hospitality and inclusion. The point here is that immigration is a hot button issue in many countries, not just the US. And it's certainly so in my home country of Singapore, which is where I'm from originally. And I suspect it's also the case in Finland. It is against this larger socio-political backdrop that Katerina's dissertation is situated. In her dissertation, and as explained in her lecture, she explores the underexplored area of advanced language proficiency development of L2 Finnish speakers. I am grateful to Katerina for reminding us that language teaching is political, as is language learning. In other words, learning a language is more than just acquiring vocabulary and grammar. In other words, we need to take into account the sociocultural and sociopolitical processes that underpin language learning and language teaching processes. In her dissertation, Katerina guides us through the trajectory and experiences of her focal participants as they negotiate school and society. She draws on research in SLA, sociolinguistics, and sociology. What is important is that she gives us a glimpse into the rich sociolinguistic lives of immigrant and transnational learners as they traverse linguistic and cultural borders. I'd like to point out also the very interesting context in which this examination is taking place. Our candidate, Katharina, is herself originally from Germany, who has examined L2 Finnish development. The dissertation was written in English, and this segment of the examination is taking place in English too. So the very multilingual encounter that we read about in the dissertation is, of course, being exemplified in this very event. I would like to add also that in her dissertation, Katharina brings together the important constructs of language, identity, and ideology. And she applies nexus analysis in order to investigate the complex social phenomenon that her focal students encountered. So on that note, I'd like to invite you over the next hour to engage in a larger dialogue with Katharina and me as we talk about this fascinating study, a study that looks at how proficient L2 Finnish learners help to negotiate identity and ideological issues as they are held up to native speaker benchmarks. Such a native speaker benchmark, of course, can sometimes serve as a gatekeeping function. So on that note, I'd like to invite Katharina to sit down and take a seat, and let's begin our discussion.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. I'm glad we managed to get rid of that echo, and it's so much clearer right now. Thank you again, Katharina, for fascinating dissertation and for that wonderful introductory lecture. I'd like to go back to your introductory lecture where you mentioned that in a taken for granted way, knowing Finnish is connected to being Finnish. And not knowing Finnish is connected to being a foreigner. Could you briefly remind us why this assumption is problematic, that knowing Finnish is connected to being Finnish and not knowing Finnish is connected to being a foreigner?
Yeah, thank you. So this is an assumption that can, of course, not be easily found anywhere. It was impossible, for example, to find any literature on this topic in particular. But many researchers have here and there noticed the same kind of effects. For instance, the fact that many foreigners or learners of Finnish get addressed in English, even if they try to initiate a conversation in Finnish, and this is something I've experienced myself as well. So there are many sort of little clues to this being the case. There's also, I would say, a broader discursive environment that I've tried to get into in the background chapter of my thesis, where I explain that Finland the history of Finland and the history of Finnish language is very much connected to this identity of a small and oppressed language. And that maybe, or some people have speculated that maybe because of this, there's a certain kind of protectiveness around Finnish language. So that it is something that is not very readily shared with others because it's seen as something that is threatened to begin with. Mm-hmm. But of course, the problem in the here and now and with the situation you pointed to a moment ago, migration and transnational movements and so on, ideologies and these ideas around Finnish language, these notions, that used to be maybe at some point useful for building a national identity, they have become very problematic because it means that they are not welcoming necessarily to newcomers. Although it has to be said that the actual discourse around language skills in Finland is very contradictory, because at the same time, like in most other places, language learning is held up as one of the most important tools of integration and of finding employment. So there's like contradictory discourses exist that point into different directions here. So we have this requirement that immigrants should learn Finnish quickly and they need Finnish in order to integrate. But then on the other hand, there's also still some kind of these protectionist ideas around Finnish language, that it doesn't really belong to people who come from elsewhere.
Thank you. You've described the tensions very nicely and put it very elegantly for all of us. And I asked that question in a way because that is really the starting point in many ways for your study. All right. Moving on to more of a methodological question, and you worked very closely with your participants over the course of 2 years. You mentioned that your participants tried to avoid passing for native speakers by highlighting their linguistic background. Could you tell us what was their rationale for doing this and how they were able to benefit from this strategy?
Yeah, I think there were two main reasons why participants did this. One reason was that the ideology of the native speaker being something that someone cannot become later in life, but it being something very prestigious, kind of built this sense that even trying to attempt to pass for something that somebody is not was experienced by the participants as a kind of like fraud or deceit. So there was kind of like a moral dimension involved in this avoidance to pass for a native speaker, because they didn't want to be found out later. And some of them actually quite explicitly said that if the other person thinks I'm a first language speaker of Finnish and later turns out I'm not, then they're going to think I've tried to fool them all the time. And so there was like a strong sense of moral obligation to present your true self and your true background that I saw as very strongly connected to these ideologies of nativeness. Mm-hmm. And then the other reason was a bit more subtle, and it has to do with how I think all of us try to build ourselves in interaction and to try to come across as certain kinds of people. Mm-hmm. So my participants feared that if the other person read them as a native speaker, then they would also judge their language and what they want to say and their language skills according to those standards. So they were afraid to maybe slip a funny word that they really didn't, or they didn't mean to make a joke, and then the other person would think, oh, but because this person really knows what they're doing, because they're a native speaker, they would take them too seriously. And so they felt that by coming forward with information about their background, they could also kind of frame themselves as a person and frame their language use in a more beneficial way. So they would be read more positively by others as sympathetic people, for instance. Or yeah, so if they made a mistake or said something unconventional, that others would attribute it to their second language speaker status and not to them being a strange person, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's very true. In your dissertation, you describe very much in detail how your participants positioned and repositioned themselves in many ways to avoid categorization or miscategorization in that sense. I kind of want to go back to the earlier question that I asked about where they tried to avoid passing for native speakers by highlighting their linguistic background. I wanted to ask, did this strategy ever have a downside? You gave us the two reasons why they elected or chose to highlight the fact that they were not native speakers. And that was, of course, a strategic move on their end. But was there a downside to this strategy? Did it ever backfire on them? And if so, what were the consequences?
I feel that nobody reported on any negative consequences of saying, by the way, I'm from country X, or whatever they would whatever way they would phrase this in, or how they would make the other person know about their background. But one thing that is very clear is that for many of them, especially those who very frequently employed these strategies of immediately coming forward and introducing themselves, and I'm from Germany or wherever, they also experienced this as a bit of a burden. So they were kind of annoyed to, for example, having to have the same conversation over and over again, because then people would react to them telling about their background with questions, usually, oh wow, how come you speak Finnish? How long have you been here? And so on. And so many of them experienced that this it was a necessary thing for them to do, but they didn't really want to have this conversation afterwards over and over again. Right. And it was actually really striking in the data where people would kind of render these conversations in almost exactly the same phrasings independently of each other, that always these questions, how long have you been here, and oh, your Finnish is so good, and so on. So this is a very, very common experience, and some people didn't exactly mind, but others didn't really want to have this conversation all the time.
True. And then to have to tell their whole life story to strangers, among other things. Now, one of the things I enjoyed about your dissertation was that it also had an autoethnographic element to it. In the dissertation, you described the genesis of your interest, that you yourself are an L2 Finnish speaker and learner, right? In that sense. And so you're very much invested, of course, in the language learning process, and how your own language learning you describe in the dissertation has been intertwined with the experiences of your participants to some extent. So here's my next question. Okay. Ideologies are often invisible and woven with cultural assumptions and biases. How did you counter such biases as an L2 Finnish speaker yourself? And if I may ask, do you feel that you've earned linguistic legitimacy after having lived in Finland for over 10 years now? I know this is a somewhat personal question, but given the socio-political nature of the topic and the fact that you are highly reflexive in your dissertation, right? And you talked about the moral implications of the of things, and you write extensively and importantly about the ethics of doing research in your dissertation. I was just wondering if you could kind of tell us briefly about your own personal encounters in that sense, because it's something that you write about through your autoethnographic perspective that you give to your dissertation.
So just to clarify, the first part of your question referred to my own reactions to, or how would I react in similar situations?
Yeah, how did you counter such biases, if there were any biases, and how do you feel you have earned linguistic legitimacy? Or do you? Have you earned linguistic legitimacy in that sense? Yeah.
So first of all, of course, I recognize myself in many of the experiences that my participants have. I think myself, I
have a higher tolerance for passing for a native speaker than many of my participants had. I realized that afterwards that this was something new to me that I learned through them, all these rationales for not wanting to pass. So for me, it's what I do recognize is this constant calibrating or sort of in what situations do I come forward with it and in which situations do I not have to. So I think all speakers maybe draw the line in a slightly different place here. And I think I think I allow myself to pass or not pass, which, you know, you honestly, from the perspective of a speaker, you never know what happens because you never know what the other person thinks about you. Mm-hmm. There are some rare occasions when I feel like I can share some of the insights I've had myself with people. This is just one example, but when I about a week or 1.5 weeks ago, when I went to have my photograph taken for the official press release for this defense, the first question the people at the Photoshop asked me, what is my thesis about? And so I tried to explain and to give them more context. I said, like, yeah, I'm from Germany myself. And then the whole conversation started. Oh, really? We would have never thought. I would have never heard. You don't have an accent and so on. I've never met anyone who speaks Finnish like that. Usually everybody has an accent and so on. So, for example, one thing I like to say in this situation is that if I had just come in as a customer to your shop and we had, you know, had a 2-minute chat about something and I would have left, you would have never known whether I was a foreigner or a Finn. So it's kind of like, yeah. So sometimes in everyday life, there's these occasions when you can actually try to challenge people's views a bit or give them some new idea or some new input. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't happen very often. It's mostly about navigating your own space and your own identity there. Mm-hmm. And with regard to legitimacy, I do think what I've noticed myself is that there was a big difference between say still 5 years ago and maybe now. So it's an ongoing process. I think a few years back, I would be much more often in situations where I felt somehow that I was not, where I felt sort of the discrepancy between what I could say and how I could be in Finnish was much bigger than in comparison to say native speaker participants. And this is really something that you can feel and experience with your own body in situations. So it's a very kind of, it can be a very intense experience, but these situations have gotten less and less. And another thing that also my participants often pointed out was that the better you know people, the more comfortable you feel. So for example, with Finnish speaking friends, even if everybody else is a native speaker, but as long as you're seen as a person first and foremost, and not as a representative of your country or the only second language speaker they know. And so as long as these identity categories are not the main thing that is in the foreground, but it's you as a person, the better they felt and the more legitimate they felt as speakers. So it's more often maybe in context with people you don't know that well, maybe, that these issues arise, because then people will easily make use of these preconceptions. And
I want to say I'm very encouraged to hear how this gap seems to have lessened over time for you, but your response also highlights two very important things that we can learn from your dissertation. Number one is that learning a language is very much embodied, right? In that sense, it is an intellectual exercise, but it's also an embodied experience in that respect. So thanks for reminding us about that. And the other thing that you kind of highlighted was how in the process of conducting research, while you might be seeking to learn about others, you also learn a lot about yourself. Because the nature of research is that we get invested in our own research projects, and that our own identities, our own researcher identities, are intertwined with the identities of our participants. In many ways, your response has actually preempted my next question, so that's very good. That's a nice segue to the next question that I have for you. In your ethnographically oriented study, you interviewed 12 participants and worked more closely with 4 focal participants. Could you tell us briefly how you were able to build rapport with your participants? Because that's something I think all researchers need to work on, right? In order to get the rich data that you obtained for your dissertation, could you give us some insight into how you were able to successfully engage in rapport building with your participants?
Yeah, so I must admit that I think my starting point was an easy one in this case, because my participants were roughly the same age. They had a very similar background. We had shared many, many experiences already, or I could relate to their experiences. They could relate to mine. So I think this was the case with all the participants. So this was in a way an easy starting point for building rapport. And then the way I progressed was that I first interviewed all the 12 people who had signed up to participate in the study. And then in the interviews, I could already kind of feel that who was very forthcoming, who had a lot of insights, who was very eager to share, very willing to share. And of course, I think that also had something to do with having sort of, even in the course of an interview, having been able to build some rapport there. Uh-huh. So the 4 participants who in the end agreed to further be investigated ethnographically, I think those were also the 4 participants with whom there was a good connection to begin uh-huh. with, and they were all very eager to participate. Uh-huh. And then while working with them, I think that in the interviews, I was sometimes more careful about sharing my own experiences, because at least at the beginning of the interviews, I would sometimes, toward the end, I would also give more of myself, because in the beginning of the interviews, I didn't want to direct them into any particular, I didn't want to sort of tell them or sort of give them any directions on what to talk about or how to see things. So I tried at the beginning to keep it more focused on them, and then in the end I would maybe also share something of mine and then they would respond to it. So and then with the 4 participants who I worked more closely with, there was a lot more of that going on. So we had So I was able to record some interactions, and I was able to interview them more, but we also had a lot of informal conversations mm-hmm. While I was visiting them wherever they lived. And in the course of those conversations, I think I also shared quite a bit of my own experience. And in that way, I think they came to also open up maybe more, or we discussed things maybe on a more mm-hmm. equal level than just me asking them questions.
I think you were successful in building trust with your participants, right? And that's why I believe they were comfortable talking about themselves and their experiences with you. This was a 2-year-long study, right? And of course, you probably collected so much data over that period, which you examined through narrative analysis. Perhaps you could tell us, and this is a very difficult question since a lot of data were archived and analyzed by you, but if you had to identify the most compelling narrative that you encountered, what would it be? Maybe you could kind of give us a glimpse into that narrative by briefly describing this narrative and telling us why it had such a powerful impact on you.
Yeah, that is a very, very difficult question, because there were a lot of things that were very striking about the data. And sometimes it was the longer narratives, and sometimes it was like how participants phrased a certain things that really opened up a lot of interpretations. So sometimes it was also the small details that were, I think, really significant and important. I would say that I had one participant who I'm not sure I can name one narrative that she provided me with, but she was the one I probably collected the most data with. So I interviewed her three times, and her circumstances had changed quite a bit in that time frame. And I was also able to be at her workplace with her for, I think, on three separate days. And I also got to know some of her friends. And so we spent a lot of time together, and we had a lot of informal conversations. And she was also German speaking. So maybe also there was just no language issues in any way. But yeah, so with her, it was extremely interesting for me to see certain topics that she constructed. So she lived in a smaller town for Finnish, in the Finnish context, in a smaller town with few foreigners, and she had really built this kind of life where she was completely immersed in Finnish language, and she had learned Finnish very quickly, and she was studying in Finnish. But precisely because of this ideological context and this environment where she was really exotic and she was really an outsider in a way always, she had built a lot of different kind of identity strategies around that. So she had kind of maybe even encouraged a label of being the quirky German who everybody knows. Or so she made use of this kind of label, which sometimes also backfired, or she sometimes also didn't feel comfortable with it. But it was a very strong identity. So it was extremely interesting to see that she was one of the people who, in the end, when I interviewed her again, probably around a year and a half after our first interview, and her social circles had changed completely. She was in a new relationship. She knew a lot more international people all of a sudden, who mostly didn't speak Finnish. So that was a new experience for her as well. And then she also did this internship in Helsinki at a workplace that was very diverse and very international. And all of a sudden, it was just absolutely fascinating to see how just this change of environment opened up entirely new kind of identity possibilities for her, where all of a sudden she would kind of feel that this identity she had worked on for so long, that she's the German that everybody knows, kind of disappeared a bit. And she thought, okay, this for example had an impact on her. She was one of the people who usually tried to really avoid passing for a native speaker by telling everyone, "Hi, I'm from Germany." And then all of a sudden, when she had experienced this, she would say things like, "Because here in Helsinki there are so many Finnish speakers with different backgrounds, bilinguals, and people with a migration background. So, you know, I don't really need to tell anyone where I'm from. You know, it's okay because people are used to the diversity." And I think that for me was a really important moment to realize, just, or to see this clearly, how the social and ideological environment really, really has an impact on people's identities and then their practices.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point, right? Context matters, and the very fact that you had the opportunity to trace her experiences over time and space is important. As you said, initially she was living in a small Finnish town where she immersed herself in the culture, and then and next she was in Helsinki in a different relationship, and where she was, I guess, among a larger number of foreigners in that respect. It's amazing that you responded and you identified this speaker, because my question was actually this. You report that one of your participants who worked in a linguistically diverse workplace no longer felt like a foreigner. Why was this the case? And so I think you've answered that question in that sense. Thank you. Now I'm kind of in a way going to backtrack a little bit before I move on to the question about the workplace and schools. But and this is more of a theoretical question then. And since you've given us a concrete example by identifying this specific L2 Finnish speaker, I'd like you to now circle back and maybe we could talk briefly about your framework where you with the three intersecting constructs of language, identity, and ideology, right? And of course, you look at it in relation to linguistic legitimacy. Could you say a little bit more? And now that we have an individual learner identified, a specific participant, could you tell us how have these constructs of language, identity, and ideology applied to this learner? How have these constructs actually helped you better understand the very phenomenon that you chose to investigate for this dissertation? Okay,
I can maybe start with the general comments and then apply it to the example, if that's okay. So for me, I think, well, language, that is what we study. So this is part of this like you said, it's one element of these of this connection that I investigated. And identity is something that is also in second language learning has been studied quite a lot. So for me, the addition of ideology was actually the thing that I thought would bring yet another dimension to the analysis, because this is something that has, as I also explained in the thesis, this is something that comes more from sociolinguistics, for example, where people look very closely at how language is used and how is that connected to identity, but also to the larger society. So this was my rationale for picking these three things was, in a sense, to bring together or to bring a sociolinguistic perspective to studying adult second language learners. Mm-hmm. In the case of this participant, I would say that the language part was extremely interesting with her as well, because living in a smaller place where all of her friends were Finnish and were even quite locally oriented Finnish people. Some once described them as they don't really even travel abroad and they just live in their bubble here. So this was also reflected actually in the kind of language, the kind of Finnish she had learned. So she was one of the participants who had basically acquired a dialect without realizing at first. So the first time she realized that she was actually speaking a local variety of Finnish was when she traveled elsewhere and people asked her, are you from that place? And she had just not realized for her, it was just the normal kind of, it was the way her friends talked. Mm-hmm. So she talked mm-hmm. that way as well. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of, for instance, the connection between language and identity here. So on the one hand, she had this very strong, I'm in my small community, I'm the sort of the person who's different, the German, the somehow person who, she kind of had built this image of herself as a kind of a quirky person that everybody just recognizes. So there was like a lot of different identity elements involved. And then at the same time, she also had a really local identity in that way, but it only became visible when she traveled elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I think, ideology in this case is kind of what frames these experiences and possibilities in different contexts. So we could see like how when she moved from one place with its particular assumptions and its particular structures to another place, how also her identity practices changed. And I think it had a lot to do with the ideologies that she encountered through mm-hmm. through everyday life. And that is maybe something that also I thought was very important to me in my study, is that these language ideologies are not just abstract constructs that we can, you know, find in official, in policies or in political discourse or so on, but they are also things that learners, when they enter a new context, it's not just about learning words and grammar and being able to speak and participate in situations, but inevitably through the encounters you have with other people, you will also get a grasp of these ideas that sort of inform how people react to you. So mm-hmm. so if you constantly hear that people are surprised that your Finnish is good or that you speak Finnish at all, so mm-hmm. so you also get to actually know the language ideological atmosphere or of context or framework of a place, and that was important to me to kind mm-hmm. of emphasize that this the language ideologies also have this experiential dimension, that people get a sense of them through mm-hmm. their encounters with others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad that you've highlighted that ideologies don't only exist or reside in policy documents, right? That they can certainly be enacted in everyday contexts through linguistic practices and through interactions. And that's very important. And I asked that question because I wanted you to illustrate the power of the analytic framework that you chose for your dissertation. And I'm grateful for that response, right? Because a framework is only a framework, or can only be powerful if you can apply it to a set of participants in a specific context, and you did a good job in doing that. Now I'm going to kind of pull away from the study a little, all right? And the last few questions will require you to think beyond the study in a way, all right? So it's a kind of shift gears here. Drawing from this example that you gave us, where you said your friend with whom you developed a good rapport, she allowed you to visit her at work, you met some of her other co-workers and friends as well. All right, so going back to the example, how might workplaces and schools learn from this supportive environment to which your participant belonged? Because now we need to now project beyond the scope of the dissertation, and we're moving kind of into the implications segment of the dissertation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a very important and very good question, and also a very tricky one, because we're talking about ideologies and discourses, and I think there's no easy way to influence that or to change mindsets about that. It's mm-hmm. we're talking about very subtle processes where I think part of the work is to make them visible and to make people aware of them in the first place. And I think that is what I also try to do in my study, to highlight some of the experiences that especially advanced second language speakers of Finnish have in their everyday life, and how, for example, these experiences of exclusion and so on can be extremely subtle and can be brought about by things that are not intentional, maybe even. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I think that What individual workplaces can do is just by allowing for more diversity, hiring in a more diverse way overall, you create an environment in which people can see themselves represented. So it's a basic question of whether you feel you're represented in a place or whether you're the one who's like the odd one out, or whether you're the one who's different. So this is of course nothing that can be, maybe that is a very slow process probably, and it has a lot to do with also problems of the job market and attitudes of employers and so on. So there's nothing that I can concretely suggest, but what I've seen in my data is that the sheer fact that there is a certain amount of diversity at schools or at workplaces already helps those speakers to feel more like they belong and like they're not the only one who's different. Mm-hmm. And I think, the thing that could be maybe tackled on a political level is how much do policymakers focus on this advanced level of Finnish? There's a lot of focus on like lower intermediate level Finnish, which is an entrance requirement for a lot of different things. And the idea is that people learn Finnish so that they can, for example, work in a practical occupation. But then there's people like my participants who are often university educated people or work in fields that are very, where language skills are very important, and they're very important in everyday work life. So an intermediate level of Finnish is simply not enough to find work in their own field. Mm-hmm. So, and at the moment, for instance, the whole question of, there's a lot of students coming to Finland to do a master's program in English. Mm. And then there's, it is not a given, and it's often not even particularly enabled or supported that they learn a good level of Finnish on the side of that mm-hmm. master's program. So Finland basically educates incoming students in English, and then they can't necessarily find work or can't find work in Finland because their Finnish is not good enough. So an investment in really enabling language learning to a higher level also from the official side, so that we will also have de facto more speakers, like more speakers with diverse backgrounds, more proficient adult speakers of Finnish. I think that would also in the long run bring about some change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've identified two main things. Thank you. One of course is to provide the actual learning resources that seem to be lacking right now to support those, for example, those master's students who come to Finland to learn. And the other one, of course, is harder to do in some ways, right, where we need to make linguistic diversity more of the norm at the workplace. And the two are interconnected, right, because that's not going to happen overnight unless you create the right infrastructure and opportunities in a way to allow such integration into the workplace. There's no simple answer to that, okay, in that respect. So I'm going to pivot forward right now a little further. If you had a chance to extend this study through conducting a follow-up study, what would you choose to investigate and why?
So I've written about this a bit at the end of my thesis as well. But I think the two things that stand out for me would be, one, to really broaden the scope of ethnographic data to be able to follow people longer in more different contexts, maybe more people, because this was my idea from the beginning on. So one thing that is also has been one a very important motivation for doing this study was that I felt that especially these more advanced speakers, you won't find where their language learning takes place by doing a classic classroom ethnography, because they are not there. As I said a moment ago, there are not even classes offered at that level in many places. So the only way to study these speakers is by finding them as individuals and then see where do they use the language, where do they learn, where did their Finnish come from in the first place. So and this of course has also been one of the really big challenges of this work. So in the beginning, fairly inexperienced ethnographer, this was really challenging to have four different individuals and just giving them the brief that, okay, I want to be able to participate in some situations of your everyday life. And then it was really up to them to suggest places where they would feel comfortable having me around and follow them. So the data was very, very sort of diverse. Sort of there were sometimes I was at the workplace, sometimes I was just participating in a conversation that they had among friends and these kinds of things. So in a way to be able to expand that to a somewhat more systematic investigation of everyday context to the extent that you can study everyday context systematically, but I think it's very challenging and it's very important, because this is, I think, where very important things take place with regard to language learning and integration that you won't get to see by simply looking at one workplace or a classic language classroom or something like that. So I think this would I'm not sure yet how to do it or how I would do it, but this is something that I think should be attempted at least and should be developed more. And then the other thing is that I think it would be very interesting to see people who are exactly on the sort of threshold of becoming very advanced speakers of Finnish. So people who are sort of on an intermediate level or advanced intermediate level, why do some people manage to go all the way and why do others not? And I personally, because I'm my background is in socially oriented second language learning research, I don't think it is simply a question of aptitude or because this person is just more talented at language learning than the other. But I believe it has a lot to do with their concrete social circumstances. And that would be, I think, extremely interesting to see where exactly does the process stop for some people and why. And why do others go on to become really very proficient learners? Yeah, so this will be another way, like to extend it to a slightly different group or the people who are in a bit of an earlier stage than the participants in this study were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've underlined a very important thing about the material realities in which learners are situated. You talked about how you were able to shadow your participants. And I think that's very important, right? In some ways, the limitations of ISLA or instructed SLA in the sense that, as you pointed out, there weren't these affordances in a way to support advanced Finnish language development and acquisition. But at the same time, the ethnographic work that you're proposing will be labor intensive. It will require a lot of work. I don't dispute the importance, but that's something to think about as well. And maybe something to think about also was if you get into the social media lives of your participants, that might add a different dimension. The workplace is important. The school is important. Hanging out with friends gives you wonderful insights, but maybe that's that added dimension to look into to as well. But that requires a lot of trust. And going back to the idea of rapport, right? Not anyone is going to let you into their social media lives, because that's a very private aspect of their lives in that sense. Okay, good. I have two more questions, and they both have to, in a way, deal with disseminating your findings. All right. So the first question is, how do you plan to disseminate your findings to different audiences so that the voices of your participants will be heard?
So we are, at least here in Finland at the moment, we are very strongly encouraged to do this. And already around this defense, for example, there's quite a few structures. So you write a press release, and so there's attempts to really bring it to put it out there and to see whether somebody will be interested in it, and people of course share the dissertation in social media and so on. There's many opportunities also to write like popularized or popular articles and have them published, for instance. For language teachers, who I think could be a group of people who would be very interested in hearing about this. Because this is a study that aimed to first and foremost point out or make create some awareness of some of the discourses surrounding advanced Finnish language use, there's, like I said, there's I think quite little that I can directly propose in terms of policies or something like that. So I think the important thing would really be to keep talking about this at conferences, but maybe also beyond, and to write about this in different outlets so that people, so that awareness of these discourses and ideologies can maybe grow a bit.
Yeah. I'm not sure about the constitution of the participants, because I'm looking down at my screen and it looks like there are 53 participants in this webinar. And I'm hoping that a good chunk of them would also be language teachers, because you mentioned the importance to reach out to teachers, right? We've read so much about the gap between researchers and practitioners. And really, we need to make an effort to bridge that gap as much as possible. So I appreciate the fact that there was a press release and that there are certainly ways to disseminate. But I think you had said there might be a limitation in terms of being able to influence the policymakers. But I think at the meso level, working with teachers at schools will itself be a very productive end in that sense.
If I can add something to this, because so it is my impression, I've never worked as a Finnish as a second language teacher, so I don't have any experience of my own, but I know a lot of people who have, and my impression is that really most are very interested in these kinds of questions and also already very aware of problems and very eager to to work for more inclusion and social equality and so on and so forth. So I think this is a context where I don't have to go and tell people how it is, because they are already sort of very good at recognizing the problems themselves. But I think maybe one concrete thing is this discourse that I in my study also point to, this kind of how do you create, how do you construct Finnishness by and sort of non-Finnishness or foreignness, and in what context do you do this? I don't know how often I've been in a Finnish speaking situation or where, you know, just by virtue of the event being in Finnish, it was assumed that everybody there is Finnish, and you would hear phrases like us Finnish people and we do this and that, and it was kind of meant to include everyone there, which is something you would never hear at an English speaking event in Finland, because then, you know, the idea is that it's a mixed audience or there's foreigners in the audience. So there's a lot of these kind of very subtle practices that could be tackled just by a bit of awareness. And I think that teachers also, while I think that few Finnish as a second language teachers do actively reproduce any of these sort of discourses and sort of draw the boundaries in their own teaching, I think that maybe at least for advanced students, it might be really useful to also discuss their own experiences in the way that my participants have been able to discuss their experiences with me. So when people or learners go out there and try to build their Finnish speaking identities, that they would have a place to come back to and maybe discuss the reactions they have encountered. And and I think that could be an interesting maybe part of teaching Finnish at advanced levels.
Yeah, and that's something really worth thinking about, right? And maybe one of the things for you to explore in partnership with teachers would be to design workshops where you can explore ways to come up with strategies and how to facilitate this process. My last question is also, as I said, connected to the first one because it's publication related. And you mentioned that your plans to disseminate your findings to different audiences earlier. So this is a slight variation of that question. And the question goes like as follows. How would you modify your message in order to meet the needs of these different audiences? Because we have the dissertation, obviously, in its high academic form, that researchers would, among others, read. But we also want, but the message is important, right? And it needs to be communicated. So how might you carve up or perhaps modify the message depending on your audience and to whom you want to communicate that message to?
Yeah. Well, I think it's actually not impossible to talk about topics like language ideologies with people who have never heard of that term or who are not sociolinguists, but you have to just phrase it in a different way. Everybody can understand that we hold ideas about languages and that they influence how we perceive other speakers and how we like to talk ourselves and how we like to present ourselves through language. So I think kind of talking about these rather difficult concepts is not impossible in more plain speak. And at the same time, I think the examples that that my research participants have provided me with offer a very good way of conveying some very, very complex things. So I don't have to talk to everyone about ideology and indexicality and the sociolinguistic matrix and things like that. But I think through having my participants' voice heard and having them tell their stories, I think people come to realize some of these things that they are already familiar with, because everybody uses language and everybody is a language user. So I think it's not impossible in any way to connect to that experience, but try to maybe shed a different light on it or bring a new angle or perspective.
Yeah, exactly. I certainly don't disagree with you because at the end of your dissertation, you also mentioned that future research might want to focus on Finns who are born abroad, outside of the country, and you also mentioned that you might also want to work with migrant groups in Finland as well. So I think it's also important to think about, let's say, if you want to communicate your research to the parents of such individuals. So going beyond practitioners and policymakers, right, to think about different audiences, such as parents, then how would you convey that message? And so ideologies would be a good starting point, right? Because as you said, everybody has an ideology. And you need to make visible that ideology and make them more aware of any ideologies that they might have or that might be circulating within society as well. So that marks the end of my my list of questions. And so at this point, I'm ready to move on to the final statement. And I thank you for the robust responses that you've given. All right. Okay. All right. So I'll start my final statement right now. I'll try to be as brief as possible because we've been at it for over an hour right now. So I'd like to thank you again for a wonderful dissertation and a good conversation that we've had over the past hour. I think you've done a very fine job theoretically and methodologically in mapping out your dissertation by bringing in the constructs that have guided your dissertation. I think issues like native speakerism that you've mentioned, they're very important in linguistic legitimacy. These are key ideas in sociolinguistics that we also need to think about in second language acquisition. And you've applied these concepts very admirably to an underexplored population, which would be the highly proficient late language learners in the Finnish context. I am, as I said earlier, very pleased with your grasp of SLA theory and how you've managed to successfully bridge and bring together the related fields of SLA, sociology, and sociolinguistics. For the benefit of the audience, I will very quickly remind them what your two research questions were. Question one was, how are highly proficient speakers of Finnish as a second language perceived in everyday life? And how do language ideologies mediate these perceptions? And how do such speakers react to these perceptions and ideologies within their own linguistic practices? The second question is, how do highly proficient speakers of Finnish position themselves with regard to and through language use? And how do these positionings help them gain legitimacy as speakers? You have responded and answered these questions very well, very robustly, and you did it through your very rigorous methodology. You've used interviews, you've used observations, and you've also have been privy to and have had access to their everyday lives, as you mentioned before. You made friends with the friends of your participants, and then you were able to shadow your participants at the workplace, and therefore were able to get very valuable insights into their rich sociolinguistic lives. And this is important because, as you've reminded us, language learning takes place beyond the classroom. In one of the last questions earlier, you said that why is there a threshold for some people and how do we get over that threshold, right? And clearly just sticking within the classroom that's not going to give us the answers that we're looking for, specifically you're looking for. And so I encourage you in the next phase of research to pursue those interests as well. Methodologically, you worked closely and intensively with 12 participants from 6 different countries, the Czech Republic, France, Germany, Hungary, Poland, and Russia over the period of 2 years. That's an amazing time commitment. And you were also able, as I mentioned earlier, to weave into an autoethnographic dimension into your dissertation. You are highly reflexive in your analysis, and you certainly did a nice job in discussing the ethical implications of doing research and describing your own positionality. And your choice to take a narrative approach also made your work compelling and brought out the richness of your data. In terms of your findings and in conclusions, I think your findings were very logically presented, and the implications were well discussed. Thank you. And I'm glad that you were able to revisit the constructs of agency, identity, and ideology that you introduced at the start of your dissertation, later in the dissertation, and that in many ways made the entire dissertation very coherent. More often than not, dissertators do an extensive lit review, and you don't see those constructs very much in the rest of the dissertation, but you've done a very fine job in weaving in and integrating and applying the constructs that you have chosen to guide your study. So overall, I want to say thank you for a captivating dissertation. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, and I'm sure that the audience will find it equally captivating and relevant, and congratulate you on a fine job, Katharina. Thank you.
Thank you too for this very inspiring discussion. I've enjoyed it a lot, and thank you also very much for your encouragement for future work. I really appreciate that, and thank you for taking the time to be my opponent today.
My pleasure.
If anyone here has any critical comments to make on my dissertation, please ask the professors for the floor.
It seems that no addresses have been requested, so the public examination has been concluded.